Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us for an hour focused on the lives and times of the people of Central and Eastern Kentucky. We'll begin by telling you about an upcoming event that calls attention to some longtime companions that we often take for granted but have become all the more precious as the world confronts the consequences of a rapidly changing climate. The week of October 9th through the 16th is Tree Week in Lexington, where it began 4 years ago, and now some other towns. The celebration of the trees and green spaces all around us has been expanded this year to Georgetown, Berea, Hazard, and Paducah. We have representatives of three of those communities on the line. Let's begin with Heather Wilson, an arborist for the City of Lexington. Greetings, Heather.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm great. Tell us what Tree Week is all about.
Well, Tree Week is all about connecting people with trees that are in our community. It's stemmed out of a group called the Urban Forest Initiative Working Group. 2018 was our first year, so we're now in our fourth year of a week-long series of events celebrating trees. And again, you know, that goal of Tree Week is to help people connect with the trees that are around us. So often all we think about when we talk about trees is their environmental impact, which is vastly important. But I feel like just as important is that meaningful personal connection that each of us has with trees, whether or not we realize that.
Do you have a particular focus this year? We have climate change bearing down on us, and trees, of course, are very important to mitigating that.
Actually, we don't tend to have a specific focus aside from connecting people. However, this year we are spending some time speaking toward climate change. And actually, it's probably a topic that will thread itself through our future Tree Weeks as well. What we do know is that, you know, in order for us to have livable cities into the future, having better tree canopy is really one of the major ways that we can really focus and dial down that impact that it has. And so this year we are talking a lot about climate change and how people that are most heavily impacted by climate change really need a voice and some action items to help them feel like they're a part of that conversation. And so that is a big theme for us this year in Tree Week.
Okay. And how can listeners in the Lexington area learn more about what's going on during the week?
Well, to learn more about this week in Lexington, you can either just simply Google Tree Week 2021, Lexington, Kentucky, or you can go to ufi.ca.uky.edu/Tree Week. And that will take you to our list of events that are happening throughout the city. We do have a week-long series of events. Right now, we have 66 total events and counting. There's plenty that can help you get your hands dirty, including tree plantings and tree cleanup events and hikes and tree IDs. But there's lots of just educational activities as well. Fayette County Public Schools is one of our partners, as is the Lexington Public Library and the Living Arts and Science Center. Our parks, Raven Run and McConnell Springs, has plenty of activities available for both young and old. So there are an extraordinary variety of events available for people to become involved this year.
Okay, sounds like a great week. That's Heather Wilson, arborist for the City of Lexington. Thank you, Heather.
Thank you.
And we're joined now by Jenny Williams in Hazard. Jenny is past chair of Pathfinders of Perry County. That's a nonprofit citizens action group that promotes community well-being, engagement, outdoor recreation, and education, and, of course, trees. Hi, Jenny. Welcome to Eastern Standard.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
And so why did Hazard decide to join the celebration?
We're so excited about this, and this is actually the fourth year that we have joined Tree Week, and I think that we decided to join it just because Dr. Linden, our president, is so committed to sustainability and to trees.
What are your plans? How do you plan to celebrate?
We're really excited. We're doing a couple of different things, several different things. We've got something every day. We have a series of videos that David Logston, who's an environmental educator, has put together that we'll be putting out. We're going to be doing workshops on how to treat woolly adelgids in hemlocks and how to treat emerald ash borers in ash trees. We're going to be doing a couple of guided hikes where we can learn to measure trees and assess their worth, which seems kind of silly because, of course, we all think trees are worth all kinds of things, but there's a really cool statewide program going on for people to adopt a tree and learn to measure it and to enter that data into a statewide database. So we're hoping to get trees from every county in Kentucky entered into that, and we're looking forward to that. We're going to be doing some, this is not quite trees, but we're sneaking in a pollinator garden workshop simply because we have such beautiful pollinator gardens on our Hazard campus. So we're really excited about the whole week. We'll be giving out coloring sheets in the schools, and we've got just a lot of fun stuff planned for families, kids of all ages, and adults too.
So how can listeners in and around Hazard find out more about this?
It's super easy. They can just go to Hazard Community and Technical College's website, and we've got a page dedicated to Tree Week with information about all the events that we're doing. You can also get on the main Tree Week page from the University of Kentucky and the Urban Forest Initiative, and they have links to all of the satellite cities that are participating and the things that they have planned. So, you know, just Google Tree Week, and I think you can pop something up in whichever community you want to know. So we're really grateful to our IT department at the college for putting together such a beautiful page for us, and all that information is right out there.
Okay, that's Jenny Williams in Hazard. Thank you, Jenny.
Thank you.
Berea will be joining this year's Tree Week celebration, and with us is Wendy Warren, Forestry Outreach Center Coordinator at Berea College. Greetings, Wendy.
Hello. So nice to be with you.
So tell us about Berea joining the Tree Week celebration. What's happening?
Oh, we're so excited to be a part of this this celebration of trees. We have some wonderful trees on campus and in the community. And, of course, the Forestry Outreach Center is located right at the edge of the Pinnacles hiking area. So my office is surrounded by trees all the time. It's a chance for us to honor the plants that give us life.
Well, you know, this is a particularly sensitive time to be thinking about that because of what we've heard from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change concerning our climate situation. And, of course, trees are key to mitigating climate change.
Absolutely, yes. There are so many ways we rely on trees. And one of the things that I like thinking about the most is what the interactions of the parts of the ecosystem, including trees, can teach us about human communities, the ways they communicate with each other, the ways that they support each other in communities and across species in communities, and the way the biodiversity of the forest can teach us about how to operate in human communities.
So what do you have planned for the week? What will be happening around Berea?
We have a week of activities. We have something each day planned, and many of them are hikes in different areas. We've got such wonderful hiking opportunities around Berea. And the Guild Fair actually kicks off Tree Week. So at the Pinnacles, the base of the Pinnacles, Berea has its annual Guild Fair, and that's the beginning of Tree Week. And then Monday, we'll have a contemplation walk. One of the ways I like to talk about with people about the kind of mental health that can happen for us when we're walking in the forest, we're going to do a walk sort of to think about, it's called In the Company of Trees, to just remember that our bodies are made to be on the land, our feet on the soil rather than on pavement, and our bodies remember, they react in ways that tell us that they remember that that's what they're made for. And so when I feel off balance, I go into the forest and find my balance. So this walk will be an opportunity for people to experience that. It'll be a mile or less, about an hour long. And then there'll be a Zoom presentation that day about how not to kill a tree, by Amanda Sears from UK Extension. Then Tuesday, we'll have a Tree Week fun hike. We're going to meet at Anglin Falls and just hike up toward Anglin Falls, which is about an hour to an hour and a half hike. Wednesday is Berea College's Mountain Day, which this year is only open to the college community, but we'll be celebrating trees all that day. And we'll also have a nature art gallery in the Forestry Outreach Center classroom that will begin that day and run through Saturday. Thursday, we have a Hidden Life of Trees walk, so we'll talk about some of that interconnectivity that I mentioned earlier and some of the ways we can learn from forest communities and apply that to human communities. On Friday, the nature art display will continue. We'll do a walk at the Brushy Fork Bridge for the Berea College community, and we'll also invite homeschoolers that day for two different presentations, one called All About Trees. So we'll just work with students I actually have students become trees, and we look at the bark, and we look at our skin. We talk about the cambium layer just underneath the bark and how that's like the veins that bring nutrients and water to our bodies. And then the second activity that day will be a tree ID hike that homeschoolers can also attend. And then on Saturday, there'll be a table at the farmer's market, again titled How Not to Kill a Tree by the Madison County Extension through UK. And the nature art display will continue. And we have a group hike every Saturday at 1 o'clock at the Forestry Outreach Center. So that week, it'll be focused on trees.
Okay. And how can listeners in and around Berea learn more?
We will have events posted on our Facebook page, which is Berea College Forestry Outreach Facebook page, and on Instagram, and we'll have posters up around the city, so people will be able to find it out that way, too.
All right. That's Wendy Warren, Forestry Outreach Center Coordinator at Berea College. Thank you, Wendy.
Thank you so much. Great talking with you.
And in case you missed it, Tree Week is set for October 9th through the 16th.
Standing here, the old man said to me, long before these crowded streets, here stood my dreaming tree. Below it he would sit for hours at a time. Now progress takes away what forever took to find. And now is
how is climate change affecting the forests of eastern Kentucky? It's our question for Greg Abernathy, Executive Director of the Kentucky Natural Lands Trust. Greg's many missions include land acquisition to protect forests, and we're going to get into that in just a minute. Welcome back to Eastern Standard, Greg.
It's nice to be with you again, Tom.
The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, recently released the first portion of its sixth assessment report on how the scale of recent changes across the climate system are unprecedented over many centuries, maybe thousands of years, and that many changes are now irreversible for centuries, maybe millennia. That's in present tense. It's no longer speculative. So as one who is close to one of those canaries in the coal mine, forests, what's your thinking about the situation we now find ourselves in?
Well, it's quite startling, and I think as the UN rolled out the report, they called it a code red for humanity, mm-hmm. which is absolutely correct. I think that there are a few things about the report that are quite notable and worth bringing forward for our listeners. And the most important is that in this report, unlike past reports, they definitively said that it's unequivocal. The planet is warming and humans are the cause. In the past, there was more guarded language about this, but 195 nations approved this report and they are calling out what has been understood to be happening as definitive. And this is a real call to humanity to take immediate, swift action if we're going to address this.
Right. These reports have never been given to hyperbole like this. So I think the language itself really caught a lot of attention, didn't it?
It absolutely did. It called for this need for immediate, rapid, and large-scale reduction in greenhouse gas emissions. If we are to keep our climate from rising up to 2 degrees Celsius, and what's really startling is a lot of this is already baked in. We need to take those actions to stop even more extreme climate impacts, but we've already baked in a lot of impacts that we're going to be dealing with for decades, regardless of our actions today.
Would you say that this IPCC report is something of a clarion call, kind of earth to humans as go the forest, goes you in the forest lands that you monitor? Are you seeing noticeable impact of climate change?
Well, I think that we're seeing climate change throughout the world and here in Kentucky, absolutely, as well. The impacts are varied. One thing where we sit in Kentucky is that we're inside the continent in this temperate zone. So we're somewhat buffered from some of the frontline impacts of climate change that we're seeing around the world. But there's no doubt that those impacts are coming with climate change to our forest here. We know that invasive species continue to expand at alarming rates, and new ones are arriving all the time in our state that undermine and disrupt our ecological systems that are here. We know that we're getting more intense rain events that our forests can't always absorb, and we have a history of pretty extensive extraction, and particularly the eastern part of the state, that has sort of disrupted some of those natural systems that could be better buffers for some of these climate impacts that we're seeing.
We've done quite a lot of interviewing lately about reforesting, especially on abandoned coal mine sites around the area in Appalachia in general. Should we, and given this IPCC report as a background, should we be considering forests an actual solution?
Yes, absolutely. There is a big push throughout the United States and around the world for what's called natural climate solutions. It's this idea of really leaning in to these opportunities where there's absorption of carbon in natural sinks. Those can be through protection of existing intact forest and wetlands and even grasslands. It's also about improving management of the lands that we utilize for the resources that we need, the working forests, the croplands, the grazing lands. And then to the point that you were just speaking to, it's restoration of the forests and wetlands and grasslands that have been graded or cleared in our previous activities on the planet. So these natural climate solutions are seen as vital to keeping us under the 2 degrees Celsius mark of climate change or elevation in the climate. And they're thought that they could account for 1/3 of the annual reductions that are needed to address climate change.
Okay, let's talk about one of these solutions that is under your purview. I'm talking about Pine Mountain. And first, I think we should explain that we're not talking about a single mountain. We're talking about a pretty expansive landscape. Is that correct?
Yes, that is a great way to lean in to talk about Pine Mountain. Though it is named a mountain, it's really a long linear ridge line. And for your listeners who may not be familiar with it, maybe I'll spend just a moment and paint a little bit of a picture of what Pine Mountain is.
Sure.
It's a quite an exquisite forested corridor that stretches 125 miles. It starts in Tennessee. It goes through eastern Kentucky on up to Virginia. The mountain's home to thousands of species of plants and animals. Nearly 100 of those species are considered rare, and there's even a few that are found nowhere else on the entire planet. The forests that we find along the mountain are incredibly lush. They're towering, massive trees, and it's nestled right in the mixed mesophytic forest that's found throughout central Appalachia. This is the second most diverse temperate zone forest found on planet Earth there throughout central Appalachia. There's also headwater streams of the Cumberland, Kentucky, and the Big Sandy rivers that flow off the mountain. They're part of the fourth largest watershed on the planet. And there are these amazing, unique natural features, such as the largest old growth forest in the state at Blanton Forest, the 60-foot waterfall at Bad Branch, and on and on and on. And finally, I'd like to mention that the mountain's also bordered by a series of wonderful local communities.
An additional 139 acres of Pine Mountain forest land was recently added to Warbler Ridge Preserve. Tell us about this addition.
Yes, we just finalized this transaction this summer, and we worked with a family that was looking for a way to honor their family legacy. It had been land that had been in their family for a very long time, and it was land that we had been talking with them for quite a while about the possibility of a purchase. So ultimately, this summer, after many years of negotiations and sitting on porches and meeting with family members, we were able to finalize the purchase of what was called the Henry and Delia Blanton Creech addition to our Warbler Ridge Preserve. There's a few notable things about this particular track. It's on the north face of Pine Mountain, which is some of the most lush forest on the mountain and also really important bat habitat. It's an addition to our Warbler Ridge Preserve, which has been unfolding since 2017 through a series of three transactions thus far that has taken it up to nearly 2,600 acres. And this addition is adjacent to the Pine Mountain Settlement School, which I suspect many of your listeners are familiar with, an absolutely wonderful part of eastern Kentucky and a close partner of Kentucky Natural Lands Trust. So the property buffers the school It offers the opportunity for expanded environmental education opportunities at the school while adding to our overall goals of the Pine Mountain Wildlands Corridor project that we've been working on for decades.
You mentioned some porch sitting going on there. And as we know, a lot of great conversations take place on a porch. Tell us about that negotiation process that you go through to bring these lands under protection. What's that actually like?
Well, it's very interesting for a variety of reasons. The majority of the lands that we have acquired throughout our history have been places that were not for sale. So we're approaching a family to inquire about a possible acquisition. That's particularly complicated interaction considering the history of Eastern Kentucky that's often had outsiders that have come to acquire and ultimately exploit some of the resources in the region. So it's about gaining trust and being present in the communities and contributing to those communities. So over time, we've been working and we've done these projects and we have a history to point to what we've been achieving on the mountain. So we meet families, we reach out to them, we try to pitch what our project is and how it contributes both to the wildlife corridor as well as the importance to the regional communities. And it does offer families an opportunity for family legacy when you're faced with a generational shift as the land is passed from generation to generation. It gets more complicated in its ownership, more fractured in its ownership. This offers families an opportunity to honor their family's legacy and be part of a bigger story in the region.
Well, where Pine Mountain is concerned, you're not done yet, as I understand it. You have more land that you hope to bring under protection. Is that correct?
That's right. We've been working for decades down there. And, you know, it's this model of large landscape conservation. We're thinking of that big mountain linear forested corridor that I described a moment ago. And we're being patient and persistent. And our focus remaining on that geography is resulting in lots of conservation wins. And currently, we're in an effort to expand Warbler Ridge even more. We have a series of tracts that we're working on, about 6 tracts, an additional 800 acres that we're hoping to add onto Warbler Ridge possibly this fall, if not into 2022. And we're also working this same kind of model around Blanton Forest, which was the origins of KNLT, the old growth forest near Harlan. We're working to add more and more acres to some of the preserved lands that we own there and a few other places along the mountain as we work to build out this migratory corridor of Pine Mountain, which is a matrix of public lands from state lands, like state parks and state forests, to national forest lands, to preserves. And so it's through this power of partnership with public-private partnership that we're working on this large landscape conservation vision.
Greg, do you get the sense that the information that we're getting from respected research bodies such as the IPCC about the hard facts of climate change is motivating increased forest land philanthropy?
Well, I sure hope so. I have seen an uptick in the attention, particularly our geography, is getting, because as we think about natural climate solutions, of course, forests are important in general, but forests that are in high biodiversity regions and geographies that are considered to be climate resilient are some of the best natural climate solution investments we can make on the planet. And Eastern Kentucky, particularly Pine Mountain, is just some of the prime areas that we can really take local action that transcends to global impact.
Well, you know, it's one thing to hear about all of this on the radio, to hear that, well, there's this organization taking care of things, but it's another to imagine what you as an individual can actually do about it. What's your suggestion to that person listening to us right now?
Well, there's a few things. First and foremost, I'd say embrace our natural heritage here in Kentucky. Lean in and learn a little bit more of this incredibly special place that we all call home. As you learn more, find opportunities to become involved. And of course, there's a suite of ways you can become involved. You can help elevate the story and tell more people about the efforts being made to advance conservation in the state. You can come and join us for an outing on Pine Mountain to experience it for yourself. And of course, we always welcome people to contribute to our efforts to advance these conservation lands on Pine Mountain and beyond. So there's a lot of ways to get involved. I think most important is waking up and paying attention to the importance of this wonderful place that we call home.
And one way to dig into it a little bit more is to go to your website. What's the address?
It's simply knlt.org.
All right. Greg Abernathy, Executive Director of the Kentucky Natural Lands Trust. Thanks, Greg.
Thank you, Tom. And we need to get out on the mountain together soon when we can.
Amen. Coming up after the break, Tom Eblin continues our Kentucky author series with Margaret Verbal as his guest. They talk about When Two Feathers Fell from the Sky, Verbal's page-turner, coming out in October. Cristobal Salinas is up next in the EKU Chautauqua series, and he joins us to talk about the problem with the X in Latinx.
So, for example, the Quechua, that is the second most spoken language in South America, they don't use the X. So research tells us that people that identify with a Quechua, they're saying, that live in the United States, they're saying, do not call me Latinx because my Quechua community's language don't use the X.
And it's storytelling season in Kentucky. We'll hear about a Tall Tales Fest coming up in Paris. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
This is Wendy Barnett with the Undermain Arts Minute, bringing you local and regional arts news and events. The Louisville Photo Biennial opened in September with photography exhibitions at over 50 venues throughout Louisville Metro, Southern Indiana, and Central Kentucky. This biennial festival, celebrating the medium of photography, presents works by photographers of national and international fame, as well as local and regional photographers. This year, the exhibits are presented both in person and virtually due to the pandemic. In addition to exhibitions, the biennial also presents workshops, lectures, and panel discussions, and runs through November 14th. More information about the biennial, including a calendar of events, can be found at louisvillephotobiennial.com. For in-depth writing about Kentucky and the region's arts and culture, go to undermain.art. Subscription to Undermain's newsletter can be found on the website. This has been the Undermain Arts Minute. Now back to Eastern Standard and Tom Martin.
Kentucky has a way of turning out star writers. Wendell Berry, Bobby Ann Mason, Ed McClanahan, Gurney Norman, Crystal Wilkinson, Silas House, Chris Offutt, just to name only some who can be found on that long, long list. And now, Tom Eblin, host of our series on Kentucky authors, adds that of a recent Pulitzer Prize finalist.
Lexington author Margaret Verbal published her first novel, Maud's Line, in 2015. It was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in Fiction. She followed up in 2019 with a prequel to that book, Cherokee America, which also drew a lot of praise. Next month, HMH Books will publish her third novel, When Two Feathers Fell from the Sky. Verbal's historic fiction explores her Cherokee heritage and how her people have coped with racism, violence, assimilation, and culture clashes over the past 200 years. What makes Verbal's book shine are her vivid characters and elegant writing. Margaret Verbal is here with us to talk about When Two Feathers Fell from the Sky. Margaret, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Tom, thanks for having me. It's nice to be here.
Well, tell us a little about Two Feathers, your main character, and the plot of this novel.
Well, Two Feathers is a professional Indian, really. She is a performer. She is based on the 101 Ranch, the Miller's 101 Ranch out in Oklahoma. And that the Miller's brothers had a Wild West show for decades. And by the time the book is set, which is 1926, they were farming out their performers. And so they farmed Two Feathers out to the Glendale Park Zoo in Nashville, Tennessee. And that's where the book is set.
Okay, well, you know, Glendale Park was a real place, and you were familiar with growing up in Nashville, although it, I guess, had then long been a neighborhood. But tell us a little about its history, and did it really used to be a Native American burial ground?
Well, that zoo and ultimately that neighborhood sat on a very interesting patch of land, and that's the neighborhood I grew up in. And before that, before the houses were built, it had been that park zoo, which was just evidently a fabulous place to visit. Everybody I've ever heard in my entire life talk about that park zoo, talked about in glowing terms. But before that, it had been a Civil War battlefield. And before that, it had been an Indian burial ground. So there's a lot of history right on that spot of land.
Mm-hmm. Well, what were some of your inspirations for the story?
Well, being raised in that neighborhood, there were relics of that park zoo all around. In order to walk home from school, from elementary school, I went to Glendale Elementary School for one thing, but in order to walk home, I walked across the trees, the lines of trees that had sheltered the old trolley tracks that were built to get out there. In fact, that was originally a trolley park built for the purpose of selling electricity on the weekends. And we have one of those trolley parks mm-hmm. here in Lexington. It's Woodland Park. And the trolleys used to go out to those parks, and this is all over the eastern part of the United States, and get people out of the heat in the summers in the cities and get them out in the countryside and sell electricity because the trolley cars ran on electricity.
Well, so Two Feathers is a, I guess you would call her a jumper. She rides a horse while it jumps off a tower into a pool of water.
She does, and that was a big thing, too, which went on for 7 or 8 years,
mm-hmm.
these horse divers. And it was a big pastime for people to go watch these divers dive on the backs of horses off of towers into bodies of water.
Well, this book is a real mystery. I don't want to give away any plot details, but something happens during one of her jumps, and then someone ends up dead, and the murderer is quite a mystery. But it's a real page-turner, but you also want to explore a lot of complex issues about race relations and other things. What do you want readers to take away from this story?
Well, you know, Tom, I have found out over the course of writing now 3 books that I don't have much I don't have much say about what readers do take away from stories. I'm always amazed, to tell you the truth, or often amazed about what readers take away from stories. But this book is set in 1926. It's set in the segregated South. It's got African Americans in it as major characters. It's got a title character who's a Native American, and there are a lot of white people in it. And how those people negotiate around each other is what, to me, one of the major themes of the book. But that is, you know, basically I'm telling a story, I'm telling a tale.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So all that gets carried along in the tale. That's not the purpose of the tale.
Sure.
But because it's set in 1926 in the social conditions of that age, then that is naturally part of it.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I found interesting was that you talk about a lot of aspects of traditional Cherokee culture and some of the reactions to Feathers has to things. What are some of the aspects of traditional Cherokee culture that you think are underappreciated by American society today?
You know, primarily the basic cultural value of Cherokees are number one, harmony, living in harmony. Number two, interacting with the land.
Mm-hmm.
And there are other things like education and, you know, I could name several others, but I would say that harmony is the primary thing that I think that people that really don't know anything about Indians don't recognize that not just Cherokees, but a lot of Indians are interested in balance. in getting along with people, not going to extremes, and not having open conflicts.
Well, this book is one that I could maybe see as a film adaptation. Have you gotten any interest yet from something like that?
Well, we've been contacted about that. But I don't handle any of that. I've got an agent that handles all of that. And then, you know, eventually somebody calls me up and tells me something is the way my life goes. So, So, you know, I don't know what will happen about that. We've been contacted about the other two books too.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I just sit back and write books, and whatever happens, happens.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's historical fiction, but you do a lot of really good historical research in this. And tell us a little about your process.
On this particular book, I'd known for a long time I wanted to write about that, the Glendale Park Zoo. And I began reading anything I could get on it when I finally turned my mind to it. And I also spent a lot of time in the archives of the Nashville Tennessean.
Mm-hmm.
And that park was created in the 1880s, in the late 1880s. And then the zoo came along after that. And so I started back at the very beginnings, and as far back as I could go in the Tennessean, and read everything I could about the park and about the people that I knew were around at that time. And I also read other books on the background of Nashville. And I read books on the Miller Brothers 101 ranch, too. And on cowgirls, because, you know, basically Two Feathers is a cowgirl. And there's a lot of really interesting literature on that, which I was not aware of. And so I read that and went from there.
Okay. Well, what are you working on next?
Well, you know, I'm writing a book. You know, how that goes, you know, I don't know. And it's in the phase now where, you know, I'm not ready to talk about it yet.
All right. Well, once again, the book is When Two Feathers Fell from the Sky by Margaret Verbal. Margaret, thanks for being with us today.
Tom, thanks for having me. Nice to talk to you.
Good to talk to you.
The EKU Chautauqua Lecture Series, open and free to everybody, has already heard from a National Geographic explorer and a world-renowned psychiatrist. Next, on October 7th, is Cristobal Salinas, an associate professor in the Educational Leadership and Research Methodology Department at Florida Atlantic University. His research has been featured on NPR, CNN, CNN Español, NBC News, Telemundo, and Good Morning America. And he joins us for a preview of his talk from Fort Lauderdale. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Dr. Salinas.
Thank you for the invitation.
And so you're giving the Hispanic Heritage keynote here at EKU, and the title of your talk is Navigating Latinx, Challenging the Norms of Language, Patriarchy, and Gender. Do I understand correctly that you're concerned about the common use of X as in Latinx and how that might result in confusion?
I am not necessarily concerned, but I think people are confused. When I say people, that the community, the Latino, Latina, Latinx community, of what it means. So one of the things that's very important for me to acknowledge is that my research focuses on what it is, Latinx, not who it is. That's how I started to understand, because when we use it as a who it is, it becomes an identity, right? An identity that a lot of people might not identify with. But the other component that I think about is how the term has been used or has been analyzed, right? And that's been because the Spanish language is gender, right? So O being for masculine, A being for feminine. So the Spanish language has played a significant role in this terminology. But one of the things that we think about is that the X works both in English and Spanish, but it might not work in other languages, right? So what does it mean for countries that don't speak Spanish or English? And an easy example is Brazil, who speaks Portuguese. They pronounce the X in a different way. So it's complicating that, right? The other thing, people have indigenized the X in the term Latinx. and mostly connected to the Aztlán, Ahuatl, and Zapotec languages, which are rooted or are originally from Mexico and Central America. But they, in this analysis, it's like people have forgotten about South American indigenous communities, because there are some indigenous communities that don't use the X in their alphabet, in their language, right? So, for example, the Quechua, who that is the second most spoken language in South America, they don't use the X. So research tells us that people that identify with the Quechua, they're saying, that live in the United States, they're saying, do not call me Latinx, because my Quechua communities language don't use the X. The other thing that, and one last thing, right, that I, another thing that, that people, when we think about the term Latinx, people have said that it's inclusive of all. And research shows that people say that it's inclusive of all LGBTQ, transgender, non-normative gender, non-conforming gender, gender non-specific, and other terms similar to that. But one of the things that I learned in through research is that there are Latina transgender women and Latino transgender men. So these transgender people said, do not call me Latinx because that's erasing my, my gender. But we also have to acknowledge that we have transgender Latinx people, right? So it's very complicated. So that's what I'll be speaking about.
So interesting. What do the politics of naming social identities risk?
So, you know, it has a lot of implications, but in short, one of the first things that comes to mind is how we are erasing people's lived experiences and own identities, right? But again, we can't move on without acknowledging that the USA Census has played a significant role in all of this. Because in 1930, the word that turned Mexican used to be a race, right? So you can see how social identities have evolved and has played a significant in how the USA Census has played a significant role in this terminology, right? So I always tell people it's better to ask than to make assumptions.
Tell us about your work as editor of the relatively new, cutting-edge journal committed to social change on race and ethnicity. What inspired the founding of the journal?
The journal committed to social change on race and ethnicity was a product during my doctoral studies. It's also published in partnership with a National Conference of Race and Ethnicity in American Higher Education. And it's a 32-plus a conference. And I got invited to be in their national board. And one of the conversations was of how do we recruit more faculty, or how do we create more conversations and spaces to share scholarship, right? And one of my first thoughts was, you need to have a journal, right? An open access journal that allows for these conversations on race and ethnicity to continue, right? To document history and also to make recommendations for policy, practice, and theory. But also, I believe that history deserves a second chance. And this is a way for us to not erase history, to keep everything documented and to be innovative on how to better serve our communities that self-identify with different race and ethnicity.
How does a focus on ethnicity differ from other terms like cultural studies?
One of the things that we have to understand is that all of this terminology is grounded in the USA. So it's a lot of USA-centric, right? And one of the things that we know is that people in the United States, Latino, Latina, Latinx people, are more likely to self-identify with the country of origin, right? But then within the country of origin, they have the cultural, their culture, their traditions that will differentiate differences. But the other thing that I think about this is that, again, I go back to how this data sets, or this data, like for example, the USA Census, has been created to collect data and to put us in groups. While this terminology has created a lot of discomfort about around our communities, it also creates unity, right? And that's when our ethnicities and our cultures and their ethnic backgrounds come together.
What would you say, Dr. Salinas, are some of the most important social changes that the journal scholars of ethnicity are seeking or striving for?
So one of the main things that we're that I'm seeing in the literature review, right, or in the work of my colleagues, friends in the journal, it is how people self-identified with race and ethnicity, but how data sets might erase one or the other, right? So what does it mean for a Latino that might not identify with a race, only with an ethnicity? But what does it mean also if a Latino identifies with a race, right? And how is this data being reported, right? Do they report as mixed race or multiple races? But do they also provide the name of those races? Because people are self-identifying, it's just that these data sets oftentimes don't provide us enough context. So that's one. The other one that I think about is how race, gender is playing a significant role in our communities. And it's always been there, but now we are focusing more in this research. And it's so important for us to focus on race, ethnicity, and race, gender topics because people have experienced multiple things and we need to document that. The other component that we are seeing right now is how some states are banning CRT, critical race theory, right? So again, I go back to how the journal Committee to Social Change on Race and Ethnicity, but many other journals are so important that to focus and to document how CRT, critical race theory, and ethnic studies are important in today's society.
All right, that's Cristobal Salinas, an associate professor in the Educational Leadership and Research Methodology Department at Florida Atlantic University. Dr. Salinas is the next guest speaker in the EKU Chautauqua Lecture Series. His talk on October 7th will be live streamed, and you can get those details online at chautauqua.eku.edu. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Salinas. We'll see you on the 7th.
Thank you.
It's storytelling season in Kentucky, and there are several festivals on the calendar. On October 8th through the 10th, they'll be spinning yarns and telling tall tales in Paris, Kentucky. And joining us with those details is Mary Lovell. Welcome, Mary.
Thanks for having me.
So among the storytellers in your lineup, and it's a stellar lineup, is five-time winner of the West Virginia Liars Contest, Bill Lepp. Tell us about Bill Lepp.
Bill Lepp is the funniest man I've ever heard. He's a standing performer at Stonesboro, Tennessee, which is the international storytelling event. And he now has his own television show called Man vs. History, where he does a history show. But he is still funny.
Well, tell us briefly about the other storytellers on your lineup.
Okay. Sheila Arnold is from Virginia, and she is the one who gets our storytellers for us every year. She's been coming to Paris for like 17 years to the schools to perform, and that's how I got interested in storytelling. She does workshops at Williamsburg, and she does a lot of African-American tales. She is very, very good. And then we have Josh Goforth, who is from Tennessee, originally from North Carolina, and he is a super storyteller, but in addition, he plays like 20 instruments. He is so good, especially good at the banjo and the fiddle. And then we have Motoko Dorkin. And she is originally from Japan, but has been in Massachusetts for the last 35 years. And she tells a lot of Japanese folk tales. And she also does, we have her doing an origami workshop on Saturday. And then we have Paul Strickland, who is, we always try to have one person from Kentucky. He's from Northern Kentucky, and he does a lot of stand-up comedy, but he also tells family stories, and he is very, very funny, too. And they're all very funny. They tell funny stories. It's a family-friendly event, and everybody's invited.
Why do you think we're so drawn to storytelling?
For the longest time, people thought storytelling was just standing up, reading a book. But it's not at all. It's these people are professional. They're artists of their own right, and they stand up and tell stories. and they're very, very good.
Yeah, I've been to these events, and these folks know how to spin a yarn for sure. It's, it's always riveting. Where will these events take place around town?
Well, most of them will take place at the headquarters of the Garden Club, and it's a Kentucky headquarters is what it is, up Paris, but it's located in Paris, Kentucky. And the showcase where all five storytellers will be performing is in the backyard, and it's free. And the dinner will be there too. But then we try to include as many sites and venues around town that we can. So we have, on Friday evening, we have the livery, which used to be an old horse livery and an auto repair shop, and it's been several things. But now it's an event venue. And so if we don't have it there because of the COVID, we are going to have it at the Garden Club, which is an open air and under a tent. And we also plan on having a free breakfast at Lil's Restaurant, which is downtown Paris. And we go to the school on Friday. We send the storytellers around. We have origami at the library, and we have a jam session with Josh Goforth at the Hopewell Museum. So we try to include as many as we can. On Sunday, we are all going out to the Cane Ridge Shrine, which is out on the Cane Ridge Road. And it has an old log cabin with a structure built around it for protection. And it was built back in the 1700s. So Bill Webb and Sheila Arnold will be telling stories out there on Sunday morning, Bill Webb, and then the afternoon, Sheila Arnold. So we tried to shake up the venues and move around every year.
Well, you touched on this, and it's so unfortunate that this question even needs to be asked, but what about COVID? What will be the festival protocol to keep everybody safe?
We are requiring masks. Most of it is outdoors, and we will ask people if they have been vaccinated. If they haven't been vaccinated, we ask that they please wear masks and keep social distancing.
All right, Mary Lovell with the Paris Storytelling Festival happening October the 8th through the 10th. Details are online at Paris Story Fest. That's one word, ParisStoryFest.com. Thank you, Mary.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Hope everybody comes.
That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer. Wendy Barnett, producer. Neil Kesterson, producing engineer and audio editor. Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. Eastern Standard is on air and online at weku.org or esweku.org, on the WEKU mobile app, or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. Would you like to suggest a topic or an interview? Drop us a line at es@eku.edu. For Eastern Standard and WEKU, I'm Tom Martin.